the researchers to highlight that they may have discovered a reversible form of cognitive impairment. This is a huge finding. Why? We really don't have many forms of dementia that are readily treatable, so if we can stop, and in some cases reverse, the path to dementia, identifying celiac disease in the presence of cognitive decline should become customary. What's more, such a finding further argues against chance as an explanation of the link between celiac disease and cognitive decline. When asked about the scientific reasoning behind the link, Dr. Murray mentioned the potential impact of inflammatory cytokines, those chemical messengers of inflammation that contribute to problems in the brain. One more item I'd like to point out from this study. When the researchers performed brain scans on these patients, they found noticeable changes in the white matter that could easily be confused with multiple sclerosis or even small strokes. This is the reason I always check for gluten sensitivity in patients referred to me with a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. On many occasions, I found patients whose brain changes were in fact not related to multiple sclerosis at all and were likely due to gluten sensitivity. And lucky for them, a gluten-free diet reversed their condition. The bigger picture. Recall the young man I discussed at the beginning of the chapter, who was originally diagnosed with a movement disorder called dystonia. He couldn't control his muscle tone, resulting in wild and intense spasms throughout his body that prevented him from leading a normal life. Although neurological disease or side effects to drugs are often to blame in cases like this, my belief is that a lot of dystonia and other movement disorders can be attributed simply to gluten sensitivity. In my patient's situation, once we removed gluten from his diet, his tremors and convulsive twitches came to a screeching halt. Other movement disorders, such as ataxia, which I described earlier, myoclonus, another affliction characterized by spasmodic, jerky contractions of muscles, and certain forms of epilepsy are often misdiagnosed. They are attributed to an unexplained neurological problem rather than to something as simple as gluten sensitivity. I've had several epileptic patients who've gone from considering risky surgery and relying on daily medication regimes to manage their seizures to becoming completely seizure-free through simple dietary shifts. Dr. Haji Vasilyu has similarly examined brain scans from headache patients and documented dramatic abnormalities caused by gluten sensitivity. Even a lay reader without a trained eye can easily see the impact. Take a look at the brain MRI scans in the accompanying PDF. For more than a decade, Dr. Haji Vasilyu has repeatedly shown that a gluten-free diet can result in complete resolution of headaches in patients with gluten sensitivity. In a 2010 review for The Lancet Neurology, he makes a clarion call for change in how we view gluten sensitivity. For him and his colleagues, nothing could be more critical than getting the word out about the connection between seemingly invisible gluten sensitivity and brain dysfunction. And I agree. Dr. Haji Vasilyu's chronicle of patients with evident signs of cognitive deficits and documented gluten sensitivity, as well as their recovery, is impossible to deny. As we've discussed, one of the most important takeaways from all the new information we've gained about celiac disease is that it's not confined to the gut. I would go so far as to say that gluten sensitivity always affects the brain. Neurobiologist Dr. Aristo Vojdani, a colleague who has published extensively on the topic of gluten sensitivity, has stated that the incidence of gluten sensitivity in Western populations may be as high as 30%. And because most cases of celiac are clinically silent, the prevalence of the disease itself is now recognized to be 20 times higher than it was thought to be two decades ago. Let me share what Dr. Rodney Ford of the Children's Gastroenterology and Allergy Clinic in New Zealand proposed in his 2009 article, aptly titled, The Gluten Syndrome, a Neurological Disease. The fundamental problem with gluten is its interference with the body's neural networks. Gluten is linked to neurological harm in patients, both with and without evidence of celiac disease. He added, evidence points to the nervous system as the prime site of gluten damage, and he boldly concluded that the implication of gluten causing neurologic network damage is immense. With estimates that at least 1 in 10 people are affected by gluten, the health impact is enormous. Understanding the gluten syndrome is important for the health of the global community. Although you may not be sensitive to gluten in the same way an individual with celiac is, I've inundated you with data for good reason. It goes to show that we may all be sensitive to gluten from a neurological standpoint. We just don't know it yet because there are no outward signs or clues to a problem happening deep within the quiet confines of our nervous system and brain. Remember, at the heart of virtually every disorder and disease is inflammation. When we introduce anything to the body that triggers an inflammatory response, we set ourselves up for taking on much greater risk for a medley of health challenges, from chronic daily nuisances like headaches and brain fog to serious ailments such as depression and Alzheimer's. We can even make a case for linking gluten sensitivity with some of the most mysterious brain disorders that have eluded doctors for millennia, such as schizophrenia, epilepsy, depression, bipolar disorder, and more recently, autism and ADHD. I'll be covering these connections later in the book. For now, I want you to get a scope of the problem, with a firm understanding that gluten can exert effects not only on the normal brain, but also on the vulnerable, abnormal brain. It's also important to keep in mind that each one of us is unique in terms of our genotype, DNA, and phenotype, how genes express themselves in their environment. Unchecked inflammation in me could result in obesity and heart disease, whereas the same condition in you could translate to an autoimmune disorder. Once again, it helps to turn to the literature on celiac disease, since celiac reflects an extreme case. It allows us to identify patterns in the course of the disorder that can have implications for anyone who consumes gluten, regardless of celiac. Multiple studies, for example, have shown that people with celiac have significantly increased production of free radicals, and they exhibit free radical damage to their fat, protein, and even DNA. In addition, they also lose their ability to produce antioxidant substances in the body as a result of the immune system's response to gluten. In particular, they have reduced levels of glutathione, an important antioxidant in the brain, as well as vitamin E, retinol, and vitamin C in their blood, all of which are key players in keeping the body's free radicals in check. It's as if the presence of gluten disables the immune system to such a degree that it cannot fully support the body's natural defenses. My question is, if gluten sensitivity can compromise the immune system, what else does it open the door to? Research has also shown that the immune system's reaction to gluten leads to activation of signaling molecules that basically turn on inflammation and induce what's called the COX-2 enzyme, which leads to increased production of inflammatory chemicals. If you're familiar with drugs like Celebrex, ibuprofen, or even aspirin, you're already familiar with the COX-2 enzyme, which is responsible for inflammation and pain in the body. These drugs effectively block that enzyme's actions, thus reducing inflammation. High levels of another inflammatory molecule called TNF-alpha have also been seen in celiac patients. Elevations of this cytokine are among the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease and virtually every other neurodegenerative condition. Bottom line, gluten sensitivity, with or without the presence of celiac, increases the production of inflammatory cytokines, and these inflammatory cytokines are pivotal players in neurodegenerative conditions. Moreover, no organ is more susceptible to the deleterious effects of inflammation than the brain. It's one of the most active organs in the body, yet it lacks bulletproof protective factors. Although the blood-brain barrier acts as a gatekeeper of sorts to keep certain molecules from crossing over from the bloodstream into our brain, it's not a foolproof system. Plenty of substances sneak past this portal and provoke undesirable effects. Later in the book, I'll go into richer detail about these inflammatory molecules and the ways in which we can use the power of food to combat them. It's time we created new standards for what it means to be gluten sensitive. The problem with gluten is far more serious than anyone ever imagined, and its impact on society is far greater than we've ever estimated. A glut of gluten in modern food. If gluten is so bad, how have we managed to survive so long while eating it? The quick answer is that we haven't been eating the same kind of gluten since our ancestors first figured out how to farm and mill wheat. The grains we eat today bear little resemblance to the grains that entered our diet about 10,000 years ago. Ever since the 17th century, when Gregor Mendel described his famous studies of crossing different plants to arrive at new varieties, we've gotten good at mixing and matching strains to create some wild progeny in the grain department. And while our genetic makeup and physiology haven't changed much since the time of our ancestors, our food chain has had a rapid makeover during the past 50 years. Modern food manufacturing, including genetic bioengineering, have allowed us to grow grains that contain up to 40 times the gluten of grains cultivated just a few decades ago. Whether this has been intentional to increase yield, appeal to people's palates, or both, is anyone's guess. But one thing we do know, modern gluten-containing grains are more addictive than ever. If you've ever felt a rush of pleasure following the consumption of a bagel, scone, donut, or croissant, you're not imagining it, and you're not alone. We've known since the late 1970s that gluten breaks down in the stomach to become a mix of polypeptides that can cross the blood-brain barrier. Once they gain entry, they can then bind to the brain's morphine receptor to produce a sensorial high. This is the same receptor to which opiate drugs bind, creating their pleasurable, albeit addicting, effect. The original scientists who discovered this activity, Dr. Christine Ziudru and her colleagues at the National Institutes of Health, named these brain-busting polypeptides exorphins, which is short for exogenous morphine-like compounds, distinguishing them from endorphins, the body's naturally produced painkillers. What's most interesting about these exorphins, and further confirms their impact on the brain, is that we know they can be stopped by opiate-blocking drugs like naloxone and naltrexone, the same drugs used to reverse the action of opiate drugs such as heroin, morphine, and oxycodone. Dr. William Davis describes this phenomenon well in his book, Wheat Belly. So this is your brain on wheat. Digestion yields morphine-like compounds that binds to the brain's opiate receptors. It induces a form of reward, a mild euphoria. When the effect is blocked, or no exorphin-yielding foods are consumed, some people experience a distinctly unpleasant withdrawal. Given what I just explained, is it any wonder that food manufacturers try to pack as much gluten into their products as possible? And is it any surprise to find so many people addicted to gluten-filled foods today, fanning the flames of not just inflammation, but the obesity epidemic? I think not. Most of us have known and accepted the fact that sugar and alcohol can have feel-good properties that entice us to come back for more. But gluten-containing foods? Your whole wheat bread and instant oatmeal? The idea that gluten can change our biochemistry down to our brain's pleasure and addiction center is remarkable and scary. It means we need to rethink how we categorize these foods if they are indeed the mind-altering agents that science proves they are. When I watch people devour gluten-laden carbohydrates, it's like watching them pour themselves a cocktail of gasoline. Gluten is our generation's tobacco. Gluten sensitivity is far more prevalent than we realize, potentially harming all of us to some degree without our knowing it. And gluten is hiding where you least suspect it. It's in our seasonings, condiments, and cocktails, and even in cosmetics, hand cream, and ice cream. It's disguised in soups, sweeteners, and soy products. It's tucked into our nutritional supplements and brand name pharmaceuticals. The term gluten-free is becoming just as vague and diluted as organic and all-natural have become. For me, it's no longer a mystery why going gluten-free can have such a positive impact on the body. For the greater part of the past 2.6 million years, our ancestors' diets consisted of wild game, seasonal vegetables, and the occasional berries. As we heard in the previous chapter, today most people's diets are centered on grains and carbs, many of which contain gluten. But even casting the gluten factor aside, I should point out that one of the main reasons why consuming so many grains and carbs can be so harmful is that they raise blood sugar in ways other foods, such as meat, fish, poultry, and vegetables, do not. High blood sugar, you'll recall, produces high insulin, which is released by the pancreas to move sugar into the body's cells. The higher the blood sugar, the more insulin must be pumped from the pancreas to deal with the sugar. And as the insulin increases, cells become less and less sensitive to the insulin signal. Basically, cells cannot hear insulin's message. What the pancreas does, as anyone would do if a person couldn't hear your message, is speak louder. That is, it increases its insulin output, creating a life-threatening feed-forward process. Higher levels of insulin cause the cells to become even less responsive to the insulin signal, and in order to deal with lowering the blood sugar, the pancreas works overtime, increasing its insulin output further, again to maintain a normal blood sugar. Even though the blood sugar is normal, the insulin level is climbing. Since cells are resistant to the insulin signal, we use the term insulin resistance to characterize this condition. As the situation progresses, the pancreas finally maximizes its output of insulin, but it's still not enough. At that point, cells lose their ability to respond to the insulin signal, and ultimately, blood sugar begins to rise, resulting in type 2 diabetes. The system has essentially broken down and now requires an outside source, that is, diabetes drugs, to keep the body's blood sugars balanced. Remember, though, that you don't have to be diabetic to suffer from chronic high blood sugar. When I give lectures to members of the medical community, one of my favorite slides is a photo of four common foods. 1. A slice of whole wheat bread. 2. A Snickers bar. 3. A tablespoon of pure white sugar. And 4. A banana. I then ask the audience to guess which one produces the greatest surge in blood sugar, or which has the highest glycemic index, GI, a numerical rating that reflects a measure of how quickly blood sugar levels rise after eating a particular type of food. The glycemic index encompasses a scale of 0 to 100, with higher values given to foods that cause the most rapid rise in blood sugar. The reference point is pure glucose, which has a GI of 100. 9 times out of 10, people pick the wrong food. No, it's not the sugar, GI 68. It's not the candy bar, GI 55. And it's not the banana, GI 54. It's the whole wheat bread at a whopping GI of 71, putting it on par with white bread. So much for thinking whole wheat is better than white. We've known for more than 30 years that wheat increases blood sugar more than table sugar, but we still somehow think that's not possible. It seems counterintuitive, but it's a fact that few foods produce as much of a surge in blood glucose as those made with wheat. It's important to note that the rise in gluten sensitivity is not only the outcome of hyperexposure to gluten in today's engineered foods. It's also the result of too much sugar and too many pro-inflammatory foods. We can also make a case for the impact of environmental toxins, which can change how our genes express themselves and whether or not autoimmune signals start to fire. Each of these ingredients, gluten, sugar, pro-inflammatory foods, and environmental toxins, combines to create a perfect storm in the body and especially the brain. If any food that foments a biological storm, despite the presence of gluten, is hazardous to our health, then we must raise another critically important question in terms of brain health. Are carbs, even good carbs, killing us? After all, carbs are often the main source of these antagonizing ingredients. Any conversation about blood sugar balance, gluten sensitivity, and inflammation has to revolve around the impact carbohydrates can have on the body and brain. In the next chapter, we'll look at how carbs in general raise risk factors for neurological disorders, often at the expense of our brain's real lover, fat. When we consume too many carbs, we eat less fat, the very ingredient our brain demands for health. Signs of gluten sensitivity. The best way to know if you're sensitive to gluten is to get tested. Unfortunately, traditional blood tests and small intestine biopsies are not nearly as accurate as the newer tests that can identify gluten antibodies just as well as genetic testing. Below is a list of symptoms and illnesses associated with gluten sensitivity. Even if you don't have any of these conditions, I urge you to employ the latest testing technology. ADHD, alcoholism, ALS, anxiety, ataxia or loss of balance, autism, autoimmune disorders, diabetes, Hashimoto thyroiditis, rheumatoid arthritis, to name a few, bone pain, osteopenia, osteoporosis, brain fog, cancer, chest pain, constantly getting sick, dairy intolerance, delayed growth, depression, digestive disturbances, gas, bloating, diarrhea, constipation, cramping, etc., heart disease, hives, rashes, infertility, irritable bowel syndrome, malabsorption of food, migraines, miscarriages, nausea, vomiting, neurological disorders, dementia, Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, etc., Parkinson's disease, seizures, epilepsy, sugar cravings. The gluten police. The following grains and starches contain gluten: barley, bulgur, couscous, farina, graham flour, kamut, matzo, rye, semolina, spelt, triticale, wheat, wheat germ. The following grains are gluten-free: amaranth, arrowroot, buckwheat, corn, millet, potato, quinoa, rice, sorghum, soy, tapioca, teff. The following foods often contain gluten: baked beans, canned, beer, blue cheeses, bouillons, broths, commercially prepared, breaded foods, cold cuts, cereals, chocolate milk, commercially prepared, communion wafers, egg substitute, energy bars, flavored coffees and teas, French fries, often dusted with flour before freezing, fried vegetables, tempura, fruit fillings and puddings, gravy, hot dogs, ice cream, imitation crab meat, bacon, etc., instant hot drinks, ketchup, malt, malt flavoring, marinades, mayonnaise, meatballs, meatloaf, malt vinegar, non-dairy creamer, oat bran, unless certified gluten-free, oats, unless certified gluten-free, processed cheese, for example, Velveeta, roasted nuts, root beer, salad dressings, sausage, seitan, soups, soy sauce and teriyaki sauces, syrups, tabbouleh, trail mix, veggie burgers, vodka, wheatgrass, wine coolers. The following are miscellaneous sources of gluten. Cosmetics, lipsticks, lip balm, medications, non-self-adhesive stamps and envelopes, Play-Doh, shampoos, conditioners, vitamins and supplements, check label. The following ingredients are often code for gluten. Avena sativa, brown rice syrup, caramel color, frequently made from barley, cyclodextrin, dextrin, fermented grain extract, Hordeum disticon, Hordeum vulgare, hydrolysate, hydrolyzed malt extract, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, soy protein, vegetable protein, HVP, maltodextrin, modified food starch, natural flavoring, phytosphingosin extract, aminopeptide complex, cicale cereale, tocopherol, vitamin E, triticum aestivum, triticum vulgare, yeast extract. Chapter 3. Attention carboholics and fat phobics. Surprising truths about your brain's real enemies and lovers. No diet will remove all the fat from your body because the brain is entirely fat. Without a brain, you might look good, but all you could do is run for public office. George Bernard Shaw. Some of my most remarkable case studies involve people transforming their lives and health through the total elimination of gluten from their diets and a new appreciation for fats instead of carbs. I've watched this single dietary shift end depression, relieve chronic fatigue, reverse type 2 diabetes, extinguish obsessive-compulsive behavior, and cure many neurological challenges, from brain fog to bipolar disorder. But apart from gluten, there's much more to the story of carbohydrates in general and their impact on brain health. Gluten isn't the only villain. To shift your body's biochemistry to one that burns fat, including the kind that never goes away, tames inflammation, and prevents illness and mental dysfunction, you need to factor in another big piece of the equation, carbs versus fats. In this chapter, I'll take you on a tour of why an extremely low-carb and high-fat diet is what your body fundamentally craves and needs. I'll also explain why consuming excess carbohydrates, even those that don't contain gluten, can be just as harmful as eating a gluten-laden diet. Ironically, ever since we scientized nutrition, the state of our health has declined. Decisions about what to eat and drink have gone from habits of culture and heritage to calculated choices based on short-sighted nutritional theories, with little consideration of how human beings reached modernity in the first place. And we can't forget about all the commercial interest out there. Do you think the makers of high-carbohydrate breakfast cereals, read, the entire aisle in your grocery store devoted to boxed cereals, truly have your health in mind? One of the most profitable businesses for food manufacturers is cereal. It's one of the only industries that can turn an inexpensive ingredient, that is, processed grains, into a pricey commodity. The R&D department for General Mills, called the Institute of Cereal Technology and located in Minneapolis, is home to hundreds of scientists whose sole purpose is to design new and tasty cereals that can command a high price and last for a long time on the shelves. Consider what you've experienced in just the past few decades. You've witnessed an untold number of ideas on what you should consume to fuel your metabolism, only to learn the opposite could be true. Take eggs, for instance. Eggs were thought to be good for you. Then they were deemed to be bad for you because of their saturated fat content. And then, the ultimate insult. More evidence is needed to determine the health effect of eggs. It's unfair, I know. With all of this white noise, it's no wonder that people feel endlessly confused and frustrated. This chapter should make you rejoice. I'm going to rescue you from a lifetime of trying to avoid eating fat and cholesterol and prove how these delicious ingredients preserve the highest functioning of your brain. We've developed a taste for fat for good reason. It's our brain's secret love. But in the last several decades, it's been demonized as an unhealthy nutritional source, and we've regrettably become a fat-phobic, carb-loving society. And it doesn't help that we automatically lower our intake of healthy fat when we eat lots of carbs. Advertisements, weight loss companies, grocery stores, and popular books are touting the idea that we should be on a low-fat, or as close to a no-fat, low-cholesterol diet as humanly possible. True, there are certain types of fat that are associated with health issues, and no one can deny the health threat linked squarely with commercially modified fats and oils. There is compelling scientific support that trans fats are toxic and are clearly linked to any number of chronic diseases. But the missing message is simple. Our bodies thrive when given good fats, and cholesterol is one of these. And we don't do so well with copious amounts of carbohydrates, even if those carbs are gluten-free, whole grain, and high in fiber. Interestingly, the human dietary requirement for carbohydrate is virtually zero. We can survive on a minimal amount of carbohydrate, which can be furnished by the liver as needed. But we can't go long without fat. Unfortunately, most of us equate the idea of eating fat to being fat, when in reality, obesity and its metabolic consequences has almost nothing to do with dietary fat consumption and everything to do with our addiction to carbs. The same is true about cholesterol. Eating high cholesterol foods has no impact on our actual cholesterol levels. And the alleged correlation between higher cholesterol and higher cardiac risk is an absolute fallacy. Fat genes and fat science. Of all the lessons in this book, the one I hope you take seriously is the following. Respect your genome. Fat, not carbohydrate, is the preferred fuel of human metabolism and has been for all of human evolution. We have consumed a high-fat diet for the past 2 million years, and it is only since the advent of agriculture about 10,000 years ago that carbohydrates have become abundant in our food supply. We still have a hunter-gatherer genome. It's thrifty in the sense that it's programmed to make us fat during times of abundance. The thrifty gene hypothesis was first described by geneticist James Neal in 1962, to help explain why type 2 diabetes has such a strong genetic basis and results in such negative effects favored by natural selection. According to the theory, the genes that predispose someone to diabetes, thrifty genes, were historically advantageous. They helped one fatten up quickly when food was available, since long stretches of food scarcity were inevitable. But once modern society changed our access to food, the thrifty genes were no longer needed, but were still active, essentially preparing us for a famine that never comes. It is believed that our thrifty genes are responsible for the obesity epidemic too, which is closely tied to diabetes. Unfortunately, it takes 40,000 to 70,000 years for any significant changes to take place in the genome that might allow us to adapt to such a drastic change in our diet and for our thrifty genes to even think about ignoring the instructions that say, store fat. While some of us like to believe we're plagued with genes that promote fat growth and retention, thus making weight loss and maintenance hard, the truth is, we all carry the fat gene. It's part of our human constitution, and for the majority of our existence on the planet, has kept us alive. Our forebears could not have had any meaningful exposure to carbohydrates, except perhaps in the late summer when fruit ripened. Interestingly, this type of carbohydrate would have tended to increase fat creation and deposition so we could get through the winter when food and calories were less available. Now, however, we signal our bodies to store fat 365 days a year, and through science, we are learning about the consequences. The Framingham Heart Study referenced in the first chapter, which identified a linear association between total cholesterol and cognitive performance, is just the tip of the iceberg. In the fall of 2012, a report in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease published research from the Mayo Clinic revealing that older people who fill their plates with carbohydrates have nearly four times the risk of developing mild cognitive impairment, MCI, generally considered a precursor to Alzheimer's disease. Signs of MCI include problems with memory, language, thinking, and judgment. This particular study found that those whose diets were highest in healthy fats were 42% less likely to experience cognitive impairment. People who had the highest intake of protein from healthy sources like chicken, meat, and fish enjoyed a reduced risk of 21%. Earlier studies examining patterns in diet and risk for dementia unveiled similar findings. One of the first studies to really compare the difference in fat content between an Alzheimer's brain and a healthy brain was published in 1998. In this post-mortem study, researchers in the Netherlands found that the Alzheimer's patients had significantly reduced amounts of fats, notably cholesterol and free fatty acids, in their cerebrospinal fluid than did the controls. This was true regardless of whether the Alzheimer's patients had the defective gene, known as APOE4, that predisposes people to the disease. In 2007, the journal Neurology published a study that looked at more than 8,000 participants who were 65 years or older and had totally normal brain function. The study followed them for up to 4 years, during which some 280 people developed a form of dementia. Most of the 280 were diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The researchers aimed to identify patterns in their dietary habits, homing in on their consumption of fish, which contains lots of brain and heart-healthy omega-3 fats. For people who never consumed fish, the risk of dementia and Alzheimer's disease during the 4-year follow-up period was increased by 37%. In those individuals who consumed fish on a daily basis, risk for these diseases was reduced by 44%. Regular users of butter had no significant change in their risk for dementia or Alzheimer's, but people who regularly consumed omega-3 rich oils, such as olive, flaxseed, and walnut oil, were 60% less likely to develop dementia than those who did not regularly consume such oils. The researchers also found that people who regularly ate omega-6 rich oils, typical in the American diet, but not omega-3 rich oils or fish, were twice as likely to develop dementia as people who didn't eat omega-6 rich oils. Interestingly, the report showed that consumption of omega-3 oils actually counterbalanced the detrimental effect of the omega-6 oils and cautioned against eating omega-6 oils in the absence of omega-3. I find results like these to be quite stunning and informative. The oh so many omegas. Which ones are good? We hear so much these days about omega-3 and omega-6 fats. Overall, omega-6 fats fall under the bad fat category. They are somewhat pro-inflammatory, and there is evidence that higher consumption of these fats is related to brain disorders. Unfortunately, the American diet is extremely high in omega-6 fats, which are found in many vegetable oils, including safflower oil, corn oil, canola oil, sunflower oil, and soybean oil. Vegetable oil represents the number one source of fat in the American diet. According to anthropological research, our hunter-gatherer ancestors consumed omega-6 and omega-3 fats in a ratio of roughly 1-to-1. Today, we consume 10 to 25 times more omega-6 fats than evolutionary norms, and we've dramatically reduced our intake of healthy, brain-boosting omega-3 fats. Some experts believe our increased consumption of brain-healthy omega-3 fatty acids was responsible for the threefold increase in the size of the human brain. The following lists the omega-6 and omega-3 content of various vegetable oils and foods. Canola oil, 20% omega-6 content, 9% omega-3 content. Corn oil, 54% omega-6 content, 0% omega-3 content. Cottonseed oil, 50% omega-6 content, 0% omega-3 content. Fish oil, 0% omega-6 content, 100% omega-3 content. Flaxseed oil, 14% omega-6 content, 57% omega-3 content. Peanut oil, 32% omega-6 content, 0% omega-3 content. Safflower oil, 75% omega-6 content, 0% omega-3 content. Sesame oil, 42% omega-6 content, 0% omega-3 content. Soybean oil, 51% omega-6 content, 7% omega-3 content. Sunflower oil, 65% omega-6 content, 0% omega-3 content. Walnut oil, 52% omega-6 content, 10% omega-3 content. Seafood is a wonderful source of omega-3 fatty acids, and even wild meat like beef, lamb, venison, and buffalo contain this fab fat. But a caveat to consider. If animals are fed grains, usually corn and soybeans, then they will not have adequate omega-3 in their diets, and their meat will be deficient in these vital nutrients. Hence the call for consuming grass-fed beef and wild fish. Beyond dementia, other neurological issues have been associated with low-fat intake and cholesterol levels in particular. In a recent report published by the National Institutes of Health, researchers compared memory function in elderly individuals to cholesterol levels. They found that the people who did not suffer from dementia had much better memory function if they had higher levels of cholesterol. The conclusion of the report crisply stated, "High cholesterol is associated with better memory function." In the discussion that followed, the researchers indicated, "It is possible that individuals who survived beyond age 85, especially those with high cholesterol, may be more robust." Parkinson's disease is also strongly related to lower levels of cholesterol. Researchers in the Netherlands, writing in the American Journal of Epidemiology, published a report in 2006 demonstrating that higher serum levels of total cholesterol were associated with a significantly decreased risk of Parkinson's disease, with evidence of a dose-effect relation. In fact, more recent research in 2008, published in the journal Movement Disorders, showed that people with the lowest LDL cholesterol, the so-called bad cholesterol, were at increased risk for Parkinson's disease by approximately 350%. To understand how this could possibly be true, it helps to recall what I hinted at in the first chapter about LDL being a carrier protein that's not necessarily bad. The fundamental role of LDL in the brain is to capture life-giving cholesterol and transport it to the neuron where it performs critically important functions. As we have now seen, when cholesterol levels are low, the brain simply doesn't work well, and individuals are at a significantly increased risk for neurological problems as a consequence. But a caveat. Once free radicals damage the LDL molecule, it's rendered much less capable of delivering cholesterol to the brain. In addition to oxidation destroying the LDL's function, sugar can also render it dysfunctional by binding to it and accelerating oxidation. And when that happens, LDL is no longer able to enter the astrocyte, a cell charged with nourishing neurons. In the last 10 years, New research has shown that oxidized LDL is a key factor in the development of atherosclerosis. Hence, we should do everything we can to reduce the risk of LDL oxidation, not necessarily levels of LDL itself. A principal player in that risk of oxidation is higher levels of glucose. LDL is far more likely to become oxidized in the presence of sugar molecules that will bind to it and change its shape. Glycosylated proteins, which are the products of these reactions between proteins and sugar molecules, are associated with a 50-fold increase in free radical formation as compared to non-glycosylated proteins. LDL is not the enemy. The problems occur when a higher carbohydrate diet yields oxidized LDL and an increased risk of atherosclerosis. In addition, if and when LDL becomes a glycosylated molecule, it cannot present cholesterol to brain cells, and brain function suffers. Somehow, we have been led to believe that dietary fat will raise our cholesterol, which will in turn increase our risk for heart attacks and strokes. This notion continues to prevail despite research from 19 years ago that proved otherwise. In 1994, the Journal of the American Medical Association published a trial that compared older adults with high cholesterol, levels above 240 milligrams per deciliter, to those with normal levels, below 200 milligrams per deciliter. Over the course of 4 years, researchers at Yale University measured total cholesterol and high-density lipoprotein, HDL, in almost 1,000 participants. They also tracked hospitalizations for heart attack and unstable angina and the rates of death from heart disease and from any other cause. No differences were found between the two groups. People with low total cholesterol had as many heart attacks and died just as frequently as those with high total cholesterol. And reviews of multiple large studies have routinely failed to find correlation between cholesterol levels and heart disease. Mounting research like this has prompted Dr. George Mann, a researcher with the Framingham Heart Study, to go on record stating, "The diet heart hypothesis that suggests that a high intake of fat or cholesterol causes heart disease has been repeatedly shown to be wrong, and yet, for complicated reasons of pride, profit, and prejudice, the hypothesis continues to be exploited by scientists, fundraising enterprise, food companies, and even governmental agencies. The public is being deceived by the greatest health scam of the century." Nothing could be further from the truth than the myth that if we lower our cholesterol levels, we might have a greater chance of living longer and healthier lives. In a recent report appearing in the prestigious medical journal The Lancet, researchers from the Netherlands studied 724 elderly individuals whose average age was 89 years and followed them for 10 years. What they found was truly extraordinary. During the study, 642 participants died. Each 39-point increase in total cholesterol corresponded to a 15% decrease in mortality risk. In the study, there was absolutely no difference in the risk of dying from coronary artery disease between the high versus low cholesterol groups, which is incredible when you consider the number of elderly folks who are taking powerful cholesterol-lowering drugs. Other common causes of death in the elderly were found to be dramatically associated with lower cholesterol. The authors reported, "Mortality from cancer and infection was significantly lower among the participants in the highest total cholesterol category than in the other categories, which largely explains the lower all-cause mortality in this category." In other words, people with the highest total cholesterol were less likely to die from cancer and infections, common fatal illnesses in older folks, than those with the lowest cholesterol levels. In fact, when you compare the lowest and highest cholesterol groups, the risk of dying during the study was reduced by a breathtaking 48% in those who had the highest cholesterol. High cholesterol can extend longevity. Perhaps one of the most extraordinary studies performed on the positive impact of cholesterol on the entire neurological system is a 2008 report published in the journal Neurology, which describes high cholesterol as a protective factor in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. There is no meaningful treatment for ALS, a devastating disease that I deal with in my medical practice on a daily basis. ALS is a chronic degenerative disorder of the body's motor neurons that leads to death within 2 to 5 years of onset. The FDA has approved one medication, Rilatec, that may extend life by approximately 3 months at best. But it's very expensive and toxic to the liver. Most patients refuse to take it. In this study from French investigators, however, it was shown that those individuals with considerably higher cholesterol ratios lived, on average, 1 year longer than patients with lower levels when compared with normal controls. As the authors stated, hyperlipidemia, high levels of cholesterol, is a significant prognostic factor for survival of patients with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. This finding highlights the importance of nutritional intervention strategies on disease progression and claims our attention when treating these patients with lipid-lowering drugs. As the infomercials say, but wait, there's more. We can't limit our talk about fat to just brain health. Volumes have been written in the scientific literature about fat and heart health as well, but not in the context I know you're thinking about. In 2010, the American Journal of Nutrition published an astonishing study that revealed the truth behind urban legends about fat, especially the saturated kind, and heart disease. The study was a retrospective evaluation of 21 previous medical reports involving more than 340,000 subjects, followed from periods of 5 to 23 years. It concluded that intake of saturated fat was not associated with an increased risk of coronary heart disease, stroke, or cardiovascular disease. In comparing the lowest to the highest consumption of saturated fat, the actual risk for coronary heart disease was 19% lower in the group consuming the highest amount of saturated fat. The authors also stated, "Our results suggested a publication bias, such that studies with significant associations tended to be received more favorably for publication." What the authors are implying is that when other studies presented conclusions that were more familiar to the mainstream, that is, fat causes heart disease, not to mention more attractive to big pharma, they were more likely to get published. The truth is, we thrive on saturated fats. In the words of Michael Gurr, Ph.D., author of Lipid Biochemistry, An Introduction, "Whatever causes coronary heart disease, it is not primarily a high intake of saturated fatty acids." In a subsequent report from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, a panel of leading researchers in the field of nutrition from around the globe clearly stated, "At present, there is no clear relation of saturated fatty acid intake to these outcomes of obesity, cardiovascular disease, incidence of cancer, and osteoporosis." The researchers went on to say that research should be directed at biological interactions between insulin resistance, reflected by obesity and physical inactivity, and carbohydrate quality and quantity. Before we look at more studies showing the benefits of fat, especially cholesterol-laden foods, let's consider how we got to the point where we reject the very foods that can feed our healthy brains and keep us supercharged for a long, vibrant life. This will require a short detour to the relationship between dietary fat and heart health, but the story ties directly into brain health. A little history. If you're like most Americans, at some time in your life you've eaten more margarine than butter, felt like you were splurging when you polished off a plate of red meat, eggs, and cheese, and gravitated toward products that said low-fat, non-fat, or cholesterol-free. I don't blame you for making these choices. We are all members of the same society that relies on experts to tell us what's good and, conversely, bad for us. We've lived through historic events in our understanding of human health over the past several generations, as well as momentous discoveries about what makes us sick and prone to disease. In fact, the turn of the 20th century marked the very beginning of a huge shift in American life due to advances in technology and medicine. Within the span of a few decades, we had widespread access to antibiotics, vaccines, and public health services. Common childhood illnesses that once gravely lowered the average lifespan were vanishing, or at least coming under better control. More people moved into cities and left their agrarian lifestyles behind. We became more educated, better informed, and ever more sophisticated. But in a lot of ways, we also became more easily tantalized and deceived by information that wasn't fully deciphered and proven yet. You might not remember the days when doctors endorsed smoking cigarettes, for instance, but this same kind of ignorance has happened on a much subtler scale in the world of dieting. And sadly, much of it continues today. In 1900, the typical city dweller consumed about 2,900 calories per day, with 40% of these calories coming from equal parts saturated and unsaturated fat. Rural families living and working on farms probably ate more calories. Theirs was a diet filled with butter, eggs, meats, grains, and seasonable fruits and vegetables. Few Americans were overweight, and the three most common causes of death were pneumonia, tuberculosis, and diarrhea and enteritis. It was also around the turn of the 20th century that the Department of Agriculture began to keep track of food disappearance, noting a change in the consumption of the kind of fats Americans were eating. People were beginning to use vegetable oils instead of butter, which prompted food manufacturers to create hardened oils through the hydrogenated process so they resembled butter. By 1950, we had gone from eating about 18 pounds of butter and a little under 3 pounds of vegetable oil each year to just over 10 pounds of butter and more than 10 pounds of vegetable oil. Margarine was rapidly gaining ground in our diets, too. At the turn of the century, people consumed only 2 pounds per person per year, but by mid-century, people were consuming around 8 pounds. Although the so-called lipid hypothesis had been around since the mid-19th century, it wasn't until the mid-20th century that scientists tried to correlate a fatty diet to fatty arteries, as deaths from coronary artery disease, CAD, began to climb. According to the hypothesis, saturated animal fat raises blood cholesterol levels and leads to the deposition of cholesterol and other fats as plaques in the arteries. To bolster this theory, a University of Minnesota public health researcher named Ansel Keys showed a nearly straight-line correlation between calories from fat in the diet and deaths from heart disease among populations across 7 countries. He ignored countries that didn't fit this pattern, including many where people eat a lot of fat but don't get heart disease, and others where the diets are low in fat, yet their populations have a high incidence of fatal heart attacks. The Japanese, whose diets have only 10% of calories coming from fat, showed the lowest CAD mortality, less than 1 in 1,000. The United States, on the other hand, had the highest CAD mortality, 7 in 1,000, with 40% of its calories coming from fat. On the surface, it would seem that these patterns point directly to the idea that fat is bad and that fat causes heart disease. Little did scientists know then that these numbers weren't telling the whole story. This erroneous thinking pervaded, however, for the next several decades as researchers looked for more proof, which included the Framingham Heart Study that found that people with higher cholesterol were more likely to be diagnosed with CAD and die from it. In 1956, the American Heart Association began pushing the prudent diet, which called for replacing butter, lard, eggs, and beef with margarine, corn oil, chicken, and cold cereal. By the 1970s, the lipid hypothesis had become well established. At the heart of this hypothesis was the unyielding claim that cholesterol caused coronary artery disease. This naturally motivated the government to do something, which led to the release